copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Greetings from Amsterdam, and look forward to interacting with you over this topic this evening about forgery. Were some of the New Testament letters written by someone else? I had a variety of reactions as I shared with friends about this webinar. Some were saying forgery. I didn't know that anybody even thought of the things in the New Testament as being forged or falsely attributed. I can't understand how there's even a topic like this tonight. That's one side that I had, one reaction. On the other hand, I had a number of other people say, oh, forgery, pseudonymity, well, that's a large word too. That's a really large topic. Well, indeed, it is a really large topic, and there have been a number of people who have been talking about this issue at the scholarly level and some at the popular level, and hence it's worth taking some time to try and address it in a practical way. This evening, I'd like to start with by looking at an overview of the topic, some common things that that some are saying about forgery and false authorship within the New Testament. I'd then like to move to a preliminary evaluation of what the scholars are saying about false authorship. And then I think the largest part of this evening, I want to read with you some texts from within early Christendom. These texts are available. They're available online, certainly in libraries, but rarely do we take the time to read the early church or ancient Greek writings as a means to address some of the topics that are found within the New Testament, including pseudonymity and forgery. And then after reading some of these texts, we'll come up with a conclusion, and then I'll look forward to a time of question and answer with you. Let's start off first. Letters in the New Testament not written by their author? What letters are we talking about? Indeed, we ought to be clear. What letters are we talking about, first of all? Scholars would say, well, they're not sure whether Ephesians was written by Paul or Colossians or 2 Thessalonians. Or 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, or Titus, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, James, or Jude. Now, I should be clear that not every scholar doubts that all of these letters was written by somebody else other than who is said to have written them. But there are a number of scholars who will doubt some of them. Some will doubt whether all of them were written by Paul, Peter, James, or Jude. So at the largest extent, 10 out of 27 books of the New Testament are being accused of being written by somebody else other than the author, or 10 out of 21 letters, that's a lot, nearly half of the letters are being stated by some scholars not to be written by the author that's stated in the New Testament. So it's a large problem. What are the implications if it's a false author, or particularly if it is forged? Well, it does have some implications about the way we read our Bible. Is the Bible a book that's supposed to be a book about truth? Is it really containing some inspired lies? And are they also of a large number? Has the canonization process, in other words, the thing that brought all of these books together, did it endorse known errors? Did some of the people who were sorting out what books should be in the Bible or some that should be left out, did they know that some of them were written by another author? That leaves us with questions, doesn't it? Could the canonization process endorse known errors? And then if there are known errors, how did those books become part of the canon? Was there pressure being exerted from these false authors so that their works might be in the canon? Or were there some powers within the church that chose to include a book not written by the author who stated? Who is doubting the authorship of New Testament letters? Actually, today, if we take a look at some college textbooks, we'll find that there are a fair number that are assuming that a number of the books that I mentioned earlier were not written by either Paul or Peter or James or Jude. Here I've given you two textbooks that are designed for university campuses, one by Bart Ehrman and another called Early Christian Reader, which incorporates not only the New Testament but several other documents from early church history. And the idea of these books is to introduce the New Testament or Christian writings, and they are saying that several of the books that I've listed, in fact, most of them are not written by the author who stated. Has this spilled over into other arenas? Yes, it has. There are popular authors now, or popular books, that are also beginning to say they're also that these New Testament letters are not written by their author. That is stated, and I've given you one book there, a small one in the lower right-hand corner, called Forged, also by Bart Ehrman. Other basic facts as we address the issue of forgery. When did false authorship claims emerge? When did these accusations first start? You have to go all the way back to 1792 in Edward Evanson's book, The Dissonance of the Four Generally Received Evangelists. And in that book, he just has a small section, but he casts doubt on whether some of the New Testament letters were written by the author who was stated there. It was F.C. Bauer, though, from the Tübingen school in the 1840s, though, that really picked up this train of thought and then started to perpetrate to a wider audience that some of the New Testament books were not written by their authors. So that's some facts, general facts about this topic. Let's now move on to some reasons. What are some reasons given for forgery or false authorship? Indeed, there are many reasons, but I've tried to summarize them into seven of the most common concerns. There are others, but here are seven of the most common ones. The first has to do with the church leadership that is supported within sections of the New Testament. The church leadership found particularly in documents like 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, 1 Peter in particular, seemed to be too advanced for first century writing. We know that Paul and Peter passed away about 64-65 AD. We know by the time of the second century that there was a much more advanced church leadership structure. Ignatius of Antioch, when he writes in his letters, speaks of supporting the bishop and how important it is to support the bishop. And the train of thought goes, for those who doubt the authorship of certain New Testament books, is that the leadership found in 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, and 1st Peter seems to favor that of the letters of Ignatius, which are dated substantially later. So hence, if the leadership ideas are late, then Paul or Peter could not have written those letters, and hence they must be forged or pseudonymous. Second reason, once again having to do with the date and the contents of the letter. The contents of the letter seem to resemble a time later when the stated author lived. Once again, returning to the pastoral epistles, but also 2 Peter can show some overlap of, once again, second century problems. Gnostic issues found in the second century could parallel some of the ideas in 1 Timothy, whether they appeal to knowledge or genealogies, or Jewish myths from Titus, or asceticism from 1 Timothy. These were all things that were known to be Gnostic concerns, and hence those who doubt the authorship of 1 Timothy or Titus say, well, it resembles Gnosticism, a second century phenomenon, and if that's the case, then they could not be written at that particular time. In 2 Peter, false teachers seem to be the issue, and that also seems to be a second century problem, So those who doubt the authorship of Second Peter would say it corresponds more to the second century, and hence Peter could not have written it. A third concern. The teaching that is found within certain letters in the New Testament seems different from the other known letters. There are a variety of scholars who certainly affirm writings like Romans or 1 Corinthians or 1 Thessalonians. And the idea goes, if we know that Paul wrote letters like that, and we know the contents that are found within them are Pauline, if another letter comes that is outside of that train of thought, then it must have been written by somebody else. So some scholars will compare 2 Thessalonians and have it compare it with 1 Thessalonians. And the doctrine of the end times seems a little different there. So they would say, well, 1 Thessalonians is by Paul, so 2 Thessalonians must have been written by somebody else. Some will look at the pastoral epistles, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, and they'll say, well, Paul definitely wrote about justification by faith. It was a very important part of his writing, but it's not found in the pastoral epistles. As a result, we must assume that the pastoral epistles were written by somebody else. Or 1 Peter and 2 Peter. I mean, some will affirm 1 Peter. Fewer will affirm 2 Peter as being by Peter, and they'll say, well, the issues are different, and hence the Peter of 1 Peter must be somebody is different than the one who is recorded in 2 Peter. The fourth concern has involved a lot of work from a man named P.N. Harrison. P.N. Harrison, one scholar, compared all of the vocabulary within the pastoral epistles. And the vocabulary within the letters, particularly 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, is different than the way that Paul normally writes. So if, after an intense investigation, out of 901 words, he found 335 not found anywhere else in Paul's writing. For that matter, a number of those words could be traced to the second century, and as a result, P.N. Harrison will claim that the pastoral epistles written by somebody else other than Paul. Fifth, the style is unlike other letters by the same author. Here we're talking about grammatical style. Has Paul in Romans and 1 Corinthians, and people can see that he writes with a similar style, but when we come to Ephesians, particularly the first chapter, the sentences are very long, and if you've studied Greek and translated in Greek, you'll know that they're quite long in Ephesians. And so the line of thought would go like this. The sentences are long. That's not Paul's style. Hence, this must be somebody who is imitating Paul and forging their name on the document. Sixth reason. The style of Greek writing is too good. The quality of Greek writing and style is too good. Peter and James have First Peter and James have a nice and a more sophisticated style of Greek. How could a peasant or a fisherman have written something like that? Since the Greek quality is too good, some scholars will doubt whether First Peter or James was written by Peter or James. And then lastly, the seventh reason, there are others, but these are being the most common ones, similarity or dissimilarity to other letters. Ephesians and Colossians are known to overlap in a lot of thought, particularly with the household codes, with the ways that fathers and mothers should act and the ways that children should respect their parents. The line of thought might go, well, we know Colossians is written by Paul, but it seems like this is a copy of what Paul is writing in Ephesians. Hence, Ephesians can't be written by Paul. Or it could go vice versa. We think Ephesians has Pauline influence in it. Somebody definitely must be forging the ideas in Colossians, as there's quite a bit of overlap. And this can go the same with 2 Peter, which is too different from 1 Peter, or 2 Peter and Jude seem to resemble each other. One of them must be written by somebody else. Or finally, James seems to contradict too many other places in the New Testament, so maybe James didn't write the letter. Okay, those are the seven most common reasons. There are others, but let's just leave it there. And now let's see if we can start to sift this through. Let's try to evaluate what we have just read about scholars' opinions about the false authorship of some New Testament letters. Let's start first by assuming, by recognizing the time in which we live. There is a high interest in forgery and conspiracy today. There's a very high interest in these things. And I appeal to the movie on the left of your slide there, Catch Me If You Can. I don't know if you've seen this movie. It's a very clever story and the acting is very good. Tom Hanks plays a man named Thomas Hanratty, and then Leonardo DiCaprio plays Frank Abagnale Jr. If you've seen the movie, you know that it's about Frank Abagnale Jr., who by age 19 has already forged many checks. And by his deception, he's able to make his way to being a doctor, to being a teacher, to being also an airline pilot. And his many tricks are able to cause him to live a rather incredible lifestyle. The story in and of itself is interesting. The movie did exceptionally well, earning over $352 million. That just showing the great interest in forgery and the ability to, by conniving, how you can earn your opinion, or particularly you can earn a lot of money. But that's not the only movie that's out there or the only book. The other day I found myself at the Maritz House, a very lovely a portrait gallery here in The Hague. And as I made my way into the bookstore with my children, I saw this book, The Art of Forgery. You can see the Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring is the cover picture for that book. And that was one of the books that was laid out in this Dutch portrait gallery. And they were expecting, of course, that they would be able to sell stories about forgery. Forgery is intriguing. The final movie on the lower right-hand corner is about a man named Wolfgang Beltracchi, who forged artwork of 20th century masters. And he did so for many, many years and earned over 30 million pounds. So once again, many, many representations of our interest of forgery and conspiracy. We ought to take that into account as we sort through these claims about false authorship. It's interesting as we trace back through history that the first doubts of false authorship didn't really even accuse of forgery. I've been intermixing the terms tonight, but scholars long ago would not have would have taken me up on that. They wouldn't have liked that because it was F.C. Bauer who said that pseudonymity, false authorship, as he was looking at the New Testament, didn't have anything to do with deception or willful forgery. It's a debated point today as to whether the false authorship on a New Testament book is an attempted forgery or is just fitting with the style at the time. Style at the time was that of some schools within the first century where false authors were not considered to be forgers. They were just carrying on the thought trait, the thoughts of the masters. So if you look at some Pythagorean letters, some Cynic letters, some Neoplatonic letters, the author would apply a false name, and it was just customary for the Greco-Roman schools. So a scholar named Abraham Mallarby, as well as others, have endorsed this false authorship, but not in terms of trickery or deception or forgery. Now, back to trying to evaluate scholars and their viewpoint of false authorship within the New Testament. Authorship designations need to be clearly defined. I was saying earlier, a false name is different than a forgery in this discussion. A false name, pseudonymity, is different than no name being applied to a letter. If the letter in the New Testament does not contain a name, particularly the book of Hebrews, then we're not talking about false authorship, pseudonymity. We're really talking about anonymity, which is different than what this discussion is about tonight. Pseudonymity, false authorship, is different than alonymity, the use of author's tradition under a false name. We're talking primarily this evening about forgery as well as pseudonymity. A third point, as we try to evaluate those who are doubting the authorship of New Testament letters. New Testament writers used a scribe, and that scribe could account for stylistic differences. Paul wrote with a scribe. He would dictate, and somebody like Tertius in Romans 16:22 would write it down. So we read there, "I, Tertius, who wrote this letter, greet you in the Lord." Are the words Paul's? Yes, they are, but they're written through a scribe, and that was just common practice at the time. Galatians 6:11 leads us to believe that maybe Paul pushed aside the scribe as he wrote the end of Galatians. "See with what large letters I am writing to you, with my own hand," perhaps pushing aside the scribe at that time. Peter, we expect that he used a scribe too. 1 Peter 5:12, "By Silvanus, a faithful brother as I regard him, I have written briefly to you, exhorting and declaring the grace of God." Now, the freedom of that hand could account for length of sentences or different words. And we also realize that different scribes could change the way that we have looked at style or perhaps vocabulary. Now, as we look at false authorship, obviously the letters were written to someone else. They were written to an audience, and the audience didn't have all the same concerns or the same amount of basic understanding. A congregation well known to Paul could receive different information than one that is less acquainted. And certainly if you're writing to a trusted leader, like a Timothy or a Titus, you could assume the contents that you would expect a congregation to know. And perhaps that counts for the different ideas. A fifth point as we evaluate false authorship, forgery and pseudonymity is a late charge, a charge that is relatively late in history. One question we should ask is, why were people fooled for so long? We don't see any records within up through, let's say, the time of the Reformation of people doubting the authorship of letters. Why were they fooled for so long? Some of these men, of course, were brilliant, some within a couple hundred years or 100 years of their writers. Why were they fooled? Is our method of reasoning now substantially better following the Enlightenment? We have to ask that question. And finally, an author's motive is difficult to measure. We're dealing with first century documents, these being written a number of years ago. How difficult it must be to get inside the mind of a forger. Why would somebody forge those documents? Why would somebody apply a false name? Does the motive for false authorship outweigh the possibility that the work really is genuine? Is the motive of deceit more or less likely within the early church? These are also questions we must answer. Okay. I want to now turn to the viewpoint of pseudepigraphy, forgery, at the time of the New Testament. Here we need to now look at some documents from within, maybe 4th century BC, going all the way up to maybe 4th, 5th century AD. What was their viewpoint of pseudepigraphy, forgery, at the time of the New Testament? Let's look briefly at Jewish, Greco-Roman, as well as Christian sources. Judaism. Judaism did have some false authorship, but these occurred in works that were largely apocalypses, In other words, end of the world type of writings. And you'll find in a book like First Enoch, an important book from the first, second century BC, that it's about the end of the world, and somebody took Enoch from Genesis 5 and placed his name on it. But that's not a letter. That is an apocalypse, an end of the world type of document. For Ezra, Second Baruch, also taking names from Judaism and applying false names to these documents, but they were apocalypses, not letters. There are two letters that could be suspicious, the letter of Aristeus and the letter of Jeremiah, but even if we look at those contents, they're nothing like that of the New Testament. The letter of Aristeus is about the history of the formation of the Septuagint, and the letter of Jeremiah reads like a sermon, so that's not really comparable to the New Testament. So I conclude that there's no real pseudepigraphy of comparable Jewish letters, and this isn't a good category to look at. A better category, and a much more promising one, is to look at Greco-Roman thought and Greco-Roman history at that time, where there are several sources that object to false authorship and certainly to forgery. And here I've taken several of the writings that my colleague Armin Baum from the ATF in Belgium has isolated in his book, or in his article, Authorship and Pseudepigraphy in Early Christian Literature. If you go back to the 5th century BC, 440 BC, Herodotus had some things to say about false authorship. And he distinguished what is authentic as well as spurious books that were attributed to Homer. And he writes this in his histories. These verses and this passage prove most clearly that the Cyprian poem are by the hand not of Homer, but of another. For the Cyprian poems relate that Alexandrus reached Ilion with Helen in 3 days from Sparta, having a fair wind and a smooth sea. But according to the Iliad, he wandered from his course in bringing her. Already starting to sort out what is true and what is of another hand. In another one of his writings, Homer speaks about a poet who needed to be banished because of interpolating. And we read this in his history. Onomaticus had been banished from Athens by Pisistratus' son, Hipparchus, having been caught by Lassus of Hermion in the act of interpolating in the writings of Musaeus an article showing that the islands of Lemnos should disappear into the sea. For this cause, Hipparchus banished him, though before that they had been close friends. That's a very interesting quote from Herodotus' writings. It doesn't have anything to do with being close friends, but if you interpolate and misrepresent, well, it's worthy of being banished from the 5th century BC, if you're looking at Greek sources. We come now to the 2nd century AD, moving forward a number of years, Diogenes Laertes. And he wrote a compendium on the lives of ancient philosophers. And he wrote this about the philosopher Empedocles, who lived between 490 and 430 BC. Timaeus, in the ninth book of his history, says he, Empedocles, was a pupil of Pythagoras, adding that, having been convicted at that time of stealing his discourses, he was, like Plato, excluded from taking part in the discussions of the school. Stealing, taking somebody else's work, leading to the exclusion from the school. Not a good thing to be caught as a false author. We now move on to Lucian of Samosata, who came across somebody wrote a document but attached a false name and attributed that to greed. So Lucian writes this: "You will permit me to praise one thing, anyhow, that very pretty performance of yours, when you yourself, and you know it, composed the Tisias' handbook, that work of an ill-omened crow." There's a rebuke if there ever was, an ill-omened crow, thus robbing that stupid old man of 30 gold pieces. For because of Tisias' name, He paid 750 drachmas for the book, gulled into it by you. There is the accusation. False authorship, not to be looked upon kindly, according to Lucian of Samosata. There are others, and we won't read all of these, but each of these Greek or Roman authors object to pseudepigraphy in some way. Galen, the physician, 2nd century AD, and as I read this, note the dates and note the occupations. Galen, the physician, Olympiodorus, the Neoplatonic philosopher, 6th century AD, Pliny, the elder, the Roman historian, 1st century AD, Pausanias, the Greek traveler, 2nd century AD, Vitruvius, the Roman architect, engineer, and writer, 1st century BC. Different centuries, different occupations, but all condemning pseudepigraphy or false authorship. Now, with this as a backdrop, let's now return to the New Testament and just ask a question, just from Greco-Roman sources that we have here. If Greco-Roman writers were not in favor of false names on a letter, why would a Christian writer who wanted to get a message across take the chance of discrediting his message by attaching a false name to audiences that emerged from a Greco-Roman background? Why would he take the chance? Better to have it be anonymous rather than to lie and be have the message be in danger of being able to be communicated to the audience. Let's now go to some ancient Christian sources, and several of these, once again, against pseudepigraphy and forgery. Here, let's look at the Moratorian Canon. Moratorian Canon giving us a listing of books from 170 AD, and within this listing of books, they talk about excluding some that were forged. So from 170 AD, we read these words. There are also in circulation one to the Laodiceans and another to the Alexandrians, forged under the name of Paul and addressed against the heresy of Marcion. And there are also several others which cannot be received into the Catholic Church, for it is not suitable for gall to be mingled with honey. There it is from 170 AD, sorting out false books from true ones, gall mingled with honey. Now, a couple decades later, in different parts of the Roman Empire, Serapion, bishop of Antioch, about 200 AD, was debating about the use of a particular gospel within the congregation. Serapion decided maybe the Gospel of Peter could be read at worship, but after further thinking about it, he decided to go back on his previous decision and disapproved of the Gospel of Peter. And he wrote these words in 200 AD, which were then later recorded within Eusebius' History of the Church about 100 years after that, in 325 AD. And he writes this, "For our part, brethren, we receive both Peter and the other apostles as Christ. But the writings which falsely bear their names, we reject as men of experience, knowing that such were not handed down to us." So now, another quarter of the Roman Empire in the Christian church rejecting false authorship. We go to St. Jerome, 381 AD, and he wrote a letter addressed to Laeta on the education of her daughter. And when it comes to false authorship, he's against it. And he writes this, or he's against reading those things from false authorship. "Let her avoid all apocryphal writings. And if she is led to read such, not by the truth of the doctrines which they contain, but out of respect for the miracles contained in them, let her understand that they are not fully writers by those to whom they are ascribed, that many faulty elements have been introduced into them, and that it requires infinite discretion to look for gold in the midst of dirt." Now, about another 150 or so years after Serapion, once again, avoiding false authorship, not worthy to be read. Athanasius, now writing in 367, sorry, mistake on the slides, 367, not 397, presupposed that the ordinary church people would be led astray by false writings, and had this to say about false authorship. Since we have spoken of heretics as dead, but of ourselves as possessing the divine scriptures for salvation, and since I fear that as Paul wrote to the Corinthians, some few of the simple should be led astray from their simplicity and purity by the subtleties of certain men, and should henceforth read other books, those called apocryphal, being deceived by the similarity of their names with the genuine books, I exhort you to bear patiently if I also write by way of remembrance, influenced by the need and advantage of the church. Athanasius, wanting to discredit those books not written by true authors, now in 367 AD. Well, let's try and turn this around for a moment. So if isolated Greco-Roman texts that would be against false authorship or forgery, we've looked at Christian writings that are against false authorship or forgery. But some would like to say the evidence is a little bit divided when you look at Christianity. Perhaps there are some sources that do speak of allowing false authorship to go forward. Let me just look at two of these with you before coming to a conclusion on this part of our evening. Could the disciples of apostles, that means the followers of the apostles, produce works of their masters? Well, if you take an isolated quote out of Tertullian's writing, Tertullian writing about 207-208 AD, it might lead you in that way. Here he's writing in a document called Against Marcion, refuting the heresy of Marcion. But then he says this, it may well seem that the works which disciples publish belong to their masters. That little quote has been taken to say, see, we have a representation of the followers of Paul or Peter or others who reproduced their writings and then slapped the name of their apostle on it. But if you read it in broader context, it refers to the Gospels of Mark and Luke and not to letters at all. Mark, of course, was picking up Peter's ideas as he wrote his gospel. More references to Peter in Mark's gospel proportionally than any other of the canonical gospels. The gospel begins with Peter and it ends with Peter. So there's a lot of thought from Peter in Mark. And we recognize that there's a lot of Paul is the influencer behind Luke's writing of the gospel too. We have no evidence of Paul or Peter schools, though, producing works like their masters when it came to letters. That just simply didn't exist. So Tertullian's quote here, not in favor of pseudonymity, as some would like to say. Could you get non-deceptive fiction? This is our last document that we'll look at tonight. It's a little lengthier one. It's an interesting one that comes from 440 AD. It involves a presbyter named Salvian who wrote one of his works under the title The Four Books of Timothy to the Church. So there you can see what the false name is. It's Timothy. Salvian's not using his own name. He's using Timothy's name. Now, Salvian's bishop, Salonius of Geneva, though, found this and then confronted him. And Salvian decided he would write back, and he defends his use of a pseudonymous author's name. So, let's read a little bit here in Salvian's epistle. Salvian writing, he says, "You have inquired of me, my beloved Salonius, why the pamphlet which someone of our own day has written to the church was published under the name of Timothy. And further, you add that unless I explain the reason for his name and why the book was ascribed to Timothy, it will probably have to be classed among the Apocrypha. For in the case of every book, we ought to be more concerned about the intrinsic value of its content than about the name of the author." See the motivation that shows up there. "And therefore, if the book is profitable reading and offers something to edify the reader, What does it matter whether or not it happens to satisfy someone's curiosity about the name of the author? Since the name is immaterial, there is no use in asking about the author's name so long as the reader profits from the book itself, so says Salvian. Why does the author not use his own name in the title of this book? Although there is only one main reason, I think several reasons could be adduced. The first is this. Based upon a divine command that we are urged to avoid every pretense of earthly vain glory, for fear that while we are covetous of the mere bauble of man's praise, we should lose our heavenly reward. And therefore, this reason alone ought to suffice as an explanation for the author's concealing his name and keeping it out of the title of his book, since he thought that what he had done for the honor of his Lord should be known only to the God himself, and that the work might please God the more as it ignored public recognition. Nevertheless, it must be confessed that the main reason lies in the fact that the writer, in his own words, is humble in his own sight, self-effacing, thinking only of his own utter insignificance. And what is more, he is this by pure faith, not by virtue of any false humility, but simply as a matter of plain fact. Therefore, since he thought, and rightly so, that others ought to regard him in the same way that he regarded himself, the author wisely selected a pseudonym for his book, for the obvious reason that he did not wish the obscurity of his own person to detract from the influence of his otherwise valuable book. For a statement is commonly taken to be worth what its author is worth. For people nowadays are so trivial and worthless that when they read, they are more concerned about the author than about what they are reading. They are more interested in the author's reputation than in the force or vigor of his words. For this reason, the present writer chose to conceal his identity in every respect for fear that his true name would perhaps detract from the influence of his book, which really contains much that is exceedingly valuable. That is the reason, whoever wants to know it, why the pamphlet was published pseudonymously. Well, that's quite an explanation, quite a lengthy explanation. There are a number of interesting points in this Salvian's ninth letter. He defends the use of a pseudonym. And while it's dated late, he does explain why the use of the pseudonym, and it's valuable in that way. He supports the contents over the author's name, and he says that it's because of humility that the pseudonym was used. Yet he also realizes that he acted clumsily and was discovered, and he knew nobody would read it once they found out that the author wasn't really who it was. He also revealed that if the early church knew it was a pseudonymous text, they would not read it also. So whether Salvian is honest or not, I mean, that's another question, but at least we have in his own words why pseudonymity and how it would have been rejected when it was found out. All right, let's try to draw a few conclusions and then we'll have some time of interaction together. Let's draw some conclusions from ancient literature and let's put that together with our prior evaluation of forgery and false authorship. Forgery is a relatively new term and it is an appealing one in a culture which likes these type of ideas. It's not surprising in a culture that likes forgery and conspiracy that there would be renewed interest in exploring about forgeries in a sacred text like the Bible. The starting point for examining forgery or pseudonymity might be the most important. Do we trust the early church or are we suspicious of it? Do we trust them? There's reason to trust. We're reading the writings of martyrs. We're reading the writings of those who had a valuable experience and trying to organize the church. Should we trust them or should we be suspicious? That might be the most important question that we ask. Many contemporary Greco-Roman writings discredit forgery. And while there are falsely ascribed Christian works, early Christian leaders are still against the practice too. So it seems that there are a fair number of writings that would be arguing against pseudonymity and forgery from the time of the early church, which leads me to the conclusion this: were there forgeries in the New Testament? And I answer,